Good morning and welcome to session number 204, Braving the New Archives World, Updating the Skills of a New Generation of Mid-Career Archivists and Records Professionals. I am not Laura Drake Davis. She was unable to be here. I'm Kate Timer and I will be your chair for today. Just a reminder that the session is being recorded. So I will, when we get to the question and answer portion, I will be repeating your questions. Before I introduce our speakers, the way we plan on running this is that the speakers will be relatively brief, and then we'd like to maximize the amount of time that we have for questions and answers. And our speakers, in order of appearance, are Peter Botticelli, who directs the Digital Information Management, or DIGIN, Graduate Certificate Program at the University of Arizona School of Information Resources and Library Science. He teaches courses in the certificate program, as well as Searles' master's program, focusing on data curation, digital librarianship, scholarly communication, and digital preservation. He holds a PhD in history from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and an MSI degree with a concentration in archives and records management from the University of Michigan School of Information. Before coming to the University of Arizona, Dr. Botticelli worked at Cornell University Library, the University of Michigan, and Harvard Business School. Susan Davis is an associate teaching professor, College of Information Science and Technology, Drexel University, where she teaches in the area of archival studies. She has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and previously served as assistant state archivist at the Wisconsin Historical Society and curator of manuscripts at the New York Public Library. Her research focuses on archives administration and education, as well as professional leadership and standards development. She has taught a range of archival topics at several universities and is a fellow of the Society of American Archivists. And last will be Kevin Glick, who is the head of University Archives and senior archivist for digital information systems at Yale University's Manuscripts and Archives. Prior to joining the Yale staff in 2002, he served as researcher and project manager of the U.S. team of the InterPARES project. Since 2007, he has been an adjunct professor at the Simmons College Graduate School of Library and Information Science, teaching managing records in electronic environments. This past year, he was also added to the faculty at Southern Connecticut State University, where he has developed and is currently teaching development of digital memorials and cultural archives. And please hold your questions to the end. As I said, we hope to have lots of time to have discussion.
Morning. I tend to be kind of loud, so I will try to keep the microphone away from my. I'm glad Kate did not tell you when I got my degrees. It was, you know, and it's partly, I think, self-serving because she and I were classmates at Michigan and suffered through hour upon hour of what archives access systems. Actually, one of the best courses I ever took in university was Terry Cook teaching archives appraisal. I wish I could go back and take it again. At any rate, I currently direct the Digital Information Management DIGIN program at Arizona. And it's interesting, I was looking at who our students were this summer and looking at all the data we have on our students we've admitted over the past 3 years that the program has been running. And it's basically a pretty even mix of mid-career professionals and newer, new professionals. And actually, we've got slightly more people, well, I should say just about exactly half of our admitted students are 40 and above, and the rest are below 40. And actually, there's slightly more people in their 50s than in their 20s. Which is not exactly what we expected when we started a program focused on technology and libraries, archives, and museums. Also, quite a few of our a majority of our students have gone more than 5 years since getting their last degree. And a third of our students have 10 years or more experience working since their last degree. So we're definitely, I would say we're very much a program that's training mid-career professionals for whatever is going to happen next in the world of digital information, which is very broadly conceived. And And I should also point out Richard Pierce Moses was one of the kind of inspiring figures. He inspires people in different ways. Sometimes, well, at any rate, the program is very broadly conceived, but it has a strong archives bias built into it, and that's partly because my bias and his bias, and well. But I've tried to characterize where our students come from, and I find it's very interesting that I can't really point to particular institutions or places where students are most coming from. About 20% of our students work for large ARL research libraries. Some are archivists, many are librarians within those institutions. But there's kind of a long tail effect of people coming from smaller colleges, universities, state archives, community colleges, public libraries, government agencies. It seems to be this basic problem of how do we manage collections is one that is a common, we have the same basic problems across many different institutions and professional groups. And what's motivating our students? And I think everyone who comes to us is very aware of the massive changes that are happening in our profession. These are technology driven, obviously, but there's also a strong sense of change within organizations and a lot of uncertainty about career paths and where we're going to go. And I think in a way, it's kind of interesting to me that the students we have, the newer students who are kind of basically new to the library profession or new to Searles, kind of almost come in with more of an idealized view of what an archives or library is. And they have this image from growing up, and that's basically kind of print-driven. Whereas I would say that the mid-career, the older folks we get, have a keener sense of what actually is changing. And I'd also say that they don't come to us with specific objectives. I get the question, are you going to teach me XML? And I say, well, yeah, of course. But they're not, I think there's a strong sense of uncertainty about what people need to do to prepare for the next 5 to 10 years and beyond in their career. And so that's part of what we try to do and dig in, is to help every individual chart their own path and develop their own particular competences. So having said that, it's sort of a context for who's coming to the program. Basically, I just want to make three arguments for why I see mid-career professionals needing further education. And of course, that's I'm not necessarily saying come and take my program, but I am. I mean, at any rate. Three arguments for why I think it's important for professionals to pursue formal education as opposed to kind of learning as much as you can in the context of your job. First, I think a formal program can give us an interdisciplinary perspective. This is something I know Kate and I were at Michigan. It was 10 years ago, and. And we heard the word interdisciplinary constantly, all the time. It got rather irritating. But I think as we look at it today, it's pretty clear that the archives profession, it's not likely that we're going to be able to build the infrastructure that we really want and really need by ourselves. We need to have collaboration across disciplinary lines. And my program has a strong, in addition to that archives bias, we also are very concerned with research data curation. And it's interesting to me the commonality of problems that people have in managing research data. And they sort of understand this idea of authenticity. Now, they don't understand it the way we do as archivists, but you know, in a way, I think archives are kind of hot right now. I mean, we have certain values, certain underlying concepts and practices that actually work in among, say, a group of science data managers, certainly digital librarians. And so, you know, we have things to offer. And at the same time, we need the resources that other disciplines have. So that's something we talk a lot about in my program. It's trying to build a common foundation for thinking about technology and what kind of infrastructure will work for us. My second argument is that as information professionals today, we find ourselves playing remarkably complex roles. And as I try to struggle to teach classes on digital, you know, collecting digital information and digital preservation especially, I find it really remarkable how complex it is to balance what we like to talk about, and we'll tell you much more about this in the session, the mix of hard skills and soft skills that professionals need. I may have a slightly different take on what hard skills are versus soft skills as our other panelists, and we can talk about this and argue about it. I see the hard skills as the very specific kinds of competences you need to work with technology. So having to, you know, wrangle a database or make a web page function correctly, you know, very specific tasks that you have to learn and, you know, practice, and very specific technology-related problems that you have to solve. And I think, you know, this is a great challenge for us because, you know, if you work with technology, you can easily spend all day trying to solve a very specific, narrow kind of problem with a particular system. So we try to build up those skills, the ability to work with systems in a specific, hands-on kind of way in my program. But at the same time, in thinking about the role we have in our institutions, there's a range of soft skills that are just as important. And to me, personally, if I had to boil down what I would say is a soft skill, it really comes down to communication. And also I would use the word culture, that, you know, we operate in a certain community of practice or a certain culture as archivists that's parallel to but different from librarians and the research data managers and the museum professionals and the records managers. So we have our own tacit knowledge. We understand, we have a certain way of thinking about collections. And yet now in this world where we have to collaborate, we need to be able to negotiate with other disciplines and communicate effectively, and not just across pull professional boundaries, but within our own institutions. And certainly at Arizona, we're seeing major changes in how the library functions, in that the traditional organizational structure is breaking down, and people are now finding themselves, and really all of my students find themselves working in a team environment where they have to be able to interact with the technology, the IT folks, as well as with information professionals, and not just, you know, archivists, but they've got to communicate with librarians and others and with administrators and explain how this complex world of digital information works. So we emphasize this, trying to get the right balance of the hard and soft skills in my program. And certainly it's difficult, and it's an ongoing process. Above all, what we try to do is to build up the learning skills that we feel our students will need, both in the short term as they go out and search for their first job after graduating, but more importantly, I think for a program like mine, it's about building a long-term career path. And clearly, if you're talking about technology itself, any particular kind of software or system that we teach today is likely to be obsolete in 5 years' time. So in a way, we say, well, it almost doesn't matter what system we're actually going to teach you or that you'll be working with. The key thing is to understand how to, or to have the ability to go out and learn something new. And it really comes down to problem solving and being able to have enough of the language, enough technological literacy to interact with those who have more skill to be able to solve specific problems. And above all, and it's also, above all, it's about processing information. It's, we're helping our students find the patterns in what's happening in the field of curation or in digital archives or in preservation so that they can go to conferences and understand the context of what's happening and be able to contribute as much as quickly as possible. But then really balance this, there's this great need to specialize today, especially in working with technology, but we also want our students to maintain a broad perspective so that they understand the policy issues and the institutional needs and the needs of the profession going forward. So I'm going to stop there, and we'll have, as I said, we'll have time to talk later.
Hello? Can you all hear me? So the focus of this session is updating professional skills mid-career. What are the needs, opportunities, challenges, and success stories for archivists? Now, we tend to talk about continuing education in very generic terms, but I think it can be kind of risky to generalize because some challenges apply to most mid-career professionals, but not all careers evolve in the same way. So different needs arise at different times and in different ways. And if you take a look at the A-Census data, that's really proof of the diversity of our universe. So I'm going to start by saying that I see mid-career retooling as falling into four different categories. I'm going to briefly describe all four, but concentrate on the latter two. The first category is really archivists for whom archives is not a first career. According to A-Census, this is true for nearly two-thirds of the respondents. I know I see some eyebrows raised there, but it is. So this means the archival profession has been enriched by individuals who bring skills and knowledge from other fields but perhaps have gaps in basic archival knowledge. For those individuals, retooling means exposure to the archival theory and practice that many receive in graduate school. The second category is archivists who missed out on academic archival education. Again, according to A-Census, almost two-thirds of archivists in their 20s came out of graduate education programs. But overall, only 35% of the total respondents to the survey identified graduate school as their primary source of archival education. Now, archivists have always learned on the job, but they often see continuing education in areas that are very similar to those who joined the profession from other fields. I mention these two categories because they often get lost in the shuffle. SAA and many of the regionals offer workshops aimed at this audience. And fortunately, some of our graduate education programs provide opportunities for students to take courses outside of full degree programs. For example, Drexel University, where I teach, has a postmaster's specialist program where individuals can receive certificates for completion of the 5-course concentration in archival studies that students can take as part of the master's program, but they can also take it separately if they somehow missed out in their graduate school. So those are two categories. But mostly when we talk about continuing education for archivists these days, we're referring to what happens as one's career evolves. And so my next two categories relate to that audience, and I'm going to spend the rest of my prepared time talking about that. And it echoes some of what Peter was saying. So number three is all the technology-related continuing education that seems to surface at the top of the radar screen. That's what comes to mind when people talk about continuing education for archivists. Because technology has drastically changed both our personal and our professional lives, as well as the very nature of archival records. Students who are currently enrolled in graduate degree programs learn about electronic records, digital preservation, metadata, web design, information retrieval in their courses. Now, obviously, these topics are a moving target. Whatever you learn rapidly becomes out of date. Peter said something about 5 years. Kate muttered 3 years. So, somewhere in there. So those of us for whom grad school is a more distant memory, and they say 10 years, I'm not telling you how long it's been for me, have even more catching up to do. So this makes pretty much anything technology-related a hot topic for archival continuing education. But, of course, that raises the question of how technical our knowledge has to be. Are we actually doing the programming or instead communicating with IST staff who handle that responsibility? So that takes me to the last category, and again, Peter mentioned the term soft skills. Retooling is not just about technology. As archivists advance within an organization or they move to higher level positions in other institutions, they often find themselves with management responsibilities, ranging from human resources to project planning to facilities planning, budgeting, outreach, advocacy. Tied to these skills are communication, collaboration, and change management. Taking a management course as part of a master's degree does not exactly suffice. Students tell me that a lot of what they hear in a management course does not register separate from real-life situations that occur later on. So these two sets of skills, seen as crucial for archivists in this new age, became the focus of a colloquium called New Skills for a Digital Era, held in Washington, D.C. in 2006. Richard, your eyes are supposed to light up now. For those who have not read about this meeting, the proceedings are on the SAA website. The colloquium brought together archivists, librarians, records managers, and other information professionals. The goal was to forge a consensus on a specific set of skills that an information professional would need to be successful in a digital environment. And that turned out to be an impossible task. As in all things archival, it depends. Instead, the focus became defining the range of issues that archivists will face in their work, and it quickly became clear that the crucial areas included both the technical or the hard skills and the facilitative or the soft skills. One dramatic consequence of technology is the removal of the walls of the archives. No longer do archivists operate in isolation, which means that the ability to talk to those with the technical knowledge becomes as important as having that knowledge. So these are all needs and challenges, and there are no quick answers. So if that's what you came for, you don't have to stay. So there are no quick answers, and the specifics change rapidly. SAA, and there are some opportunities. People continue to read and learn on the job. We have a lot of self-directed learners among us. SAA and other organizations hold face-to-face and online workshops. There were a number of them at this conference. On a more structured level, Peter talked about the program at University of Arizona. The University of North Carolina has the DigSeeker program that focuses on research as well as graduate and continuing education in the area of digital curation. I'm not saying those are the only two. Those are two that often come up. But I also want to talk about another opportunity that addresses more of the soft skills side, emphasizing leadership as well as management. For the past three summers, the NHPRC has funded the Archives Leadership Institute, run by the School of Library and Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I see a lot of veterans of the Leadership Institute in this room, and I'm sure they'll be, including one of the staff of this program, Meredith. So I'm sure people will be, we can talk about that later. The Institute arose in response to the need for continuing education for archivists who are now in a position to influence policy and affect change in their institutions, recognizing that those institutions come in many shapes and sizes. So about 25 participants have spent a week on the Madison campus each of the last three Julys, working together as a cohort and learning about leadership, collaboration and coalition building, media relations and communication, legislative advocacy, creative problem solving, managing change, mentorship, and leveraging economic impact. The relationships established at these institutes will hopefully benefit both the individuals and the institutions for which they work, much as Camp Pitt did for government archivists working with electronic records in the 1990s. To me, the Archives Leadership Institute represents a significant longitudinal opportunity to study continuing education for mid-career archivists as well as for professional leadership. 218 different individuals have applied to attend the Institute in the first 3 years, and there were 48 more. There were more applications because 48 people reapplied if they didn't make it the first year. They reapplied another year to go. And there's two more years of funding in the current grant, and so there'll be a call for applications, in January?
They'll be due in January.
When will it come out?
The new application, probably September.
Okay, but we posted on the archives listserv, or you could look at the Library School website at Wisconsin. Each applicant is required to submit a statement of interest explaining why he or she wanted to attend the Institute and what they thought the experience would accomplish. And I read all the statements, looking for threads that kind of illuminated the topic of this conference session. Well, this pool is not exactly a microcosm of the profession as a whole, because after all, these are people who actively, proactively sought this kind of education. Their statements do articulate the challenges they were facing in their careers and how they thought the Institute would help them meet those challenges. Most of the statements describe the individual's career trajectory, their sense of their strengths and weaknesses, and their goals for the future. So I'm going to end my prepared comments by describing some of the themes that bubbled up from those applications in the hopes that they'll resonate with some of you and stimulate our discussion. First, many of the applicants reflected on the direction of archives in the profession, its increasing visibility, and the breakdown of traditional boundaries among the information fields, and thus the need to be able to communicate with a diverse set of colleagues. They also talked about changes in their own institutions occurring for some of the same reasons. Several applicants reported that their institutions were in the throes of reorganization, so that managing change was going to be key to moving their units forward. A related point was a sense that those darn baby boomers were eventually going to retire and creating new leadership opportunities within their institutions. On a personal level, many described changes in their own job responsibilities, both assigned and deliberately sought. So often those changes entailed assuming management roles, strategic planning, coordination with external groups, and leading and mentoring others. These new responsibilities made the individuals conscious of their own strengths and weaknesses and their desires for self-improvement in ways that extend beyond traditional archival skills. And importantly to me, much of this was boundary spanning. Reading the statements of interest made it clear that these archivists comfortably wear both professional and institutional hats. They saw themselves as archivists. They saw themselves as employees of their institution. And they link participation in their institution to their role in the profession, arguing that one benefits the other, that it goes back and forth. They don't silo that sort of thing. My reading of the applicant statements confirms work I've done in the past on leadership in the archival profession and how leaders see the big picture. So right now we're looking at one aspect of the profession, mid-career retooling, but we're really talking about building professional leadership for the future. And to me, that's another very important topic to think about. And I'm going to stop.
Good morning. I'm going to talk a little bit different than what we've been talking about so far. I think my role in this panel is to not talk from the point of view of an archival educator or perhaps as an archival professional, but to talk for those of us that are looking for work from the point of view of an employer who's hiring. That will cause me to talk about a few different things. I am a hiring supervisor that has managed to make a few hires in the recent past and has the benefit of actually writing job descriptions in the last week. So have had some time to think about this very recently. My situation is a little bit different than some in that I'm a slightly larger organization with about 15 archival professionals associated with a large academic repository, but I think that what I'm going to say applies even down to very small repositories with perhaps one or two staff. In fact, it may apply even more. I think the first point is that, as we've heard a little bit, that mid-career professionals might be coming in from a variety of different backgrounds. The absolute most fundamental thing that I'm looking for is a firm footing in archival fundamentals. It seems obvious, but mid-career professionals may have gotten different educational training, and their responsibilities may not have necessitated that they have a very strong footing in archival fundamentals. It may have, but it's not always the case. And the reason that I think it's so important is because of all of the rest of the things that I'm going to talk about that are all technology-driven. I think that archival fundamentals are important to be able to apply those fundamentals to new technologies. And that's a real gap that I see with a lot of potential job candidates and a lot of our mid-career archivists. If I would try to enumerate some of the technological skills, competencies, or experience that are necessary, I think I might like to differentiate a little bit between a little bit more specialized types of archivists and then also talk about all archivists in general. So if I were to say archivists looking for employment, arrangement and description types of jobs, processing archivists, things like that, every one of those archivists needs to have an understanding of and more importantly experience with XML, EAD, structured data. I can't emphasize that enough. So some of us may have already pre-selected ourselves and are not down in Washington number 6 learning how to make EAD that's too complicated easier. Every one of the archivists needs to be comfortable with EAD. It is complicated, but it is a thing that there's just no going around. You can't be waiting it out hoping that EAD is a fad, right? That's that boat has sailed, and we're using it for a lot of things. It's not just the way to mark up the finding aid to display it on the web. It is really the way that we're structuring different kinds of data in a way that helps others to understand. Any of you that sat in on the very good earlier session on structured data saw some excellent presentations that explained ways that EAD help other information professionals understand how to bring together surrogate images and bibliographic data together in one way that helps to organize that thing in a sensible manner that the archivists have put together. Any arrangement and description person that we might be bringing in really needs to have experience with archival collection management systems. Something like the Archivist Toolkit or Archon or ICA Atom or any range of proprietary systems. It really needs to be experience. It can be a very limited experience, but the understanding of how those systems operate and what their connection to that first one is, how the different data elements fit into what the work that you're doing is and how it outputs into the types of description that you're going to want to show to people and how it doesn't, how it may just be used to help you to do your job. What they can do, what they can't do, and as I move down a little bit, the understanding and the ability to describe what else maybe they should do that they don't do all that well. Both of those first two sort of go together. You might take something like expertise with metadata and descriptive standards. This is just something that's it's important to really understand those that are most active in the archival community, but it's really important to be able to understand how that exists in the wider community that you might be operating in. So I operate inside an academic library system, so I need to understand what the different library metadata standards are. If I'm inside a museum, I need to understand those, whatever my situation might be. Why that's so important is as these operations start to digitally merge and work together and systems are start to be built, then all the stakeholders need to get into these committee meetings, right? We love to have these committee meetings, but I need to be able to hire people that can sit in those committee meetings and understand what's happening and come back and tell me, so I don't need to be in 14 different committee meetings, right? So the ability to have a wider range of all staff that understand those different things and can talk expertly about their own field, but then also communicate with the others is really important. And then all processing and arrangement and description archivists really need to have, and this isn't really a hard skill, but the ability to work with born digital records and apply archival concepts to them. This maybe is a flexibility and agility, or a comfort with computers. I'm not sure exactly how to define it, but we're just getting too much in. We can't have, if it's a large staff, one staff member dealing with all the computer stuff, or if we're a small staff, we can't just not bring that stuff in. We need to be able to deal with that and understand how it's similar, not just how it's completely different from the other things that we've done. A second class of jobs maybe is in around public services, dealing with outreach and public services, reference, that sort of work. Vital that a person have experience and comfort with social media, the web 2.0. When this gets defined into what the skills are, we may need to talk about this in the discussion. This can differentiate from job to job, but the ability to understand what the contemporary uses of these technologies are, how your potential patrons are using them, what they might want, how you can interact with them, what the state of the art is just vital. Beyond that, simply, I need somebody that can make edits to a web page, right? So every archives has a website that's continuing to evolve, and they may have a couple of people that can work on it. Every archivist that gets a job needs to be able to change the hours on the website, you know, at a very minimum. And if you're not able to do that, you're at a significant disadvantage when you come to interview. But, you know, more advanced sorts of things and understanding differences between static websites or websites that are more dynamic, or how you might code in Notepad versus using some sort of website, database-driven website content management. Understanding what those are and how it changes the work is just really important. I think it's vital from a public services standpoint that you understand contemporary user search and discovery behavior and the current tools and practices that are being used by many already to meet user needs. There aren't specifics that I've got to say about that. It's just sort of a general understanding that right now all students that are coming through library school or information school, they're getting that sort of training. It may not have been training a part of library school or information school when mid-career professionals went through. Now, if I went more broadly to talk about all things that all archivists need, most of it really is technological that I'm saying here, but I want to go back and say the flexibility and agility. What we're witnessing is just a lot of change with technology, and the ability to work with emerging technologies is just something that's important. It's important to have, it can be a great benefit, let's say, to have technical project management skills and experience, maybe the ability to oversee technological development projects or oversee outside contractors. A lot of discussion happens about, well, I'm not going to do any of that work myself, but you maybe need to hire somebody to do that or task someone else to do it, and you need to understand what it is to be able to find the right person, figure out if they're doing it, describe to them what they need to do, evaluate it, and figure out when it's finished. That's a very important thing. And Peter said, talked about this a little bit when he talked about communications. It's really a big communication issue, talking both languages. This is a thing that I've benefited from through my career, is sort of being the translator between the highly technical community and the archival community, and sort of trying to talk both languages. But it's something that's very important. If I'd throw out a couple more that are quite useful to all, I'd also add something like understanding even the basic fundamentals of database design and management, and how to migrate data from one system to another. This isn't a really specific hard skill, but is something that's really important and can really put you at an advantage. And if I went further, and as we talk about smaller and smaller units, the ability to triage general computing issues. This is something that I even spend a great deal of time in my job, because we only have limited resources to deal with these sorts of things. And if we're talking about a Lone Ranger, you're going to have to be able to figure out why this or that system isn't working for whatever the reason might be. All right? Thank you.
Okay, thanks to all our speakers. I would certainly think that some of that would have generated some ideas. So now we're turned to question and answer. But I should alert you that because of these two columns, I won't be able to necessarily see you if you're raising your hand back. And you probably can't see me. I guess it's like a truck. If I can't see you, you can't see me. So if you have a question and you're waving and you're not getting attention, please move in a little bit. Is there anyone who'd like to pose a question immediately? I was going to just point out, I have to repeat the question. So the question is, in terms of workshops or more short, not something short of a whole graduate program, where specifically would you recommend that people go to get training in areas such as data, more of the hard skills, database management, EAD, et cetera?
Should I do that?
Go ahead.
So the panel actually, can you hear me, has been discussing this amongst ourselves a little bit, and unfortunately there isn't one answer.
It depends.
It can depend on the situation, but... For some things, workshops can work. I think that EAD, XML, descriptive standards, there are already workshops that SAA provides that do provide help at the beginning level. To each of those, I'd say that you require time afterwards to apply those things you've learned. Otherwise, it's not doing you much good to just hear something and then not be able to work with it. And so then that's sort of the issue with a workshop model. If you're in a job and can take to the workshop real world experiences and then bring back from the workshop real things to try, you're at a great benefit. So some of these other things that were mentioned technology-wise don't work so well in the workshop model and require more time. Some of the technological fundamentals or the introduction to database design, things like that, those are more whole classes that one needs to take. That require a bigger commitment, not just in terms of maybe money, but in terms of time that you're going to have to commit over a whole semester or over a really condensed block of time. When we talked about it, I said that As an employer, I wasn't sure that I cared if you got credit for such training, and so would be happy if someone took it upon themselves to audit such a class. So anyone at an academic institution probably has the opportunity to audit for very little to no cost. That doesn't mean you don't still have to take a lot of time and effort to put into it.
I'll just add quickly that learning technology, we find the thing what we try to do within our classes, but people can certainly do it outside, is just basically just install whatever you want to work with. Get an old computer, install whatever the system is, and then just play with it and see if you can make it work. And then that gives you a set of problems. You can search. You can go online and search different resources and understand the community that's built up around a particular piece of software. And that's really where if you take a workshop, that'll sort of introduce you to that. But then to get into the hands-on, we really emphasize hands-on practice as a key thing.
I have just kind of a more structural response. When we were trying to figure out how to create a continuing ed program at Drexel last year, I spent a lot of time looking at what was out there in terms of continuing education. And it's very complicated because every one of the professional associations, ALA, all its divisions, they all have continuing education that you have to, you know, sift through what's on the RBMS website or the ACRL website or, you know, the reference section or whatever, and there's tons of stuff out there. Some of them are attached to academic institutions, some of them are not. And there's not necessarily a lot of quality control except assuming that if it comes out of a good institution or, you know, who the instructors are. And so those you just have to kind of look for. Some are face-to-face, some are online. The you've got SAA in the regionals, but in metropolitan areas, let's say like New York that has Metro, they offer a lot of stuff. A number of the graduate academic programs allow you to take single courses, and they usually advertise on their website which courses are open to people in a non-matriculated way. Illinois does that. I think Simmons does that. And so unfortunately, there's no one easy way to do it. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what other people did so we could figure out what we were going to do. The other thing that I knew you were going to talk about was the self-directed part. So,
Sure. Following a little bit up on what Peter was saying and something Kevin referred to, I mean, the social media web 2.0 stuff, which is what I do, I just did it. I mean, web 2.0 and social media is a perfect thing to do on your own. I wouldn't know too much about database management. I don't know if I'd be comfortable just buying an old computer and putting Linux on it, but maybe I would. But the self-directed, and this speaks to again, what Kevin was saying, is that he's not necessarily looking for a transcript. It's more of how you can demonstrate your knowledge, both in your application, but then, I think you were talking about this, more importantly, in the interview process, so that, you know, when he's talking to you about your technology skills, he can tell whether you know what you're talking about. And so in that regard, the sort of self-directed, do-it-yourself approach, which is, I think, so much easier with technology than it used to be because, you know, you could basically go on the web and find a tutorial that'll teach you how to do just about anything that you guys talked about in terms of technology. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely.
They're all nodding. Personally, I see a big differentiation between getting this kind of experience and the hard skills, which, you know, granted is difficult, but at least you can define what it is that you want to learn, versus the soft skills, which everybody talked about, where the question I was going to ask was more about, okay, so I know I need to know how to collaborate. Where's my class in collaboration? Or some of the other more nebulous skills. I think personally, I would be more challenged in trying to figure out how to get education in stuff like that. And since we have so much time, do any of you want to respond to the how do you get your soft skills And then we'll take another question.
Other than taking our classes?
Yes, Peter, yeah. Other than taking your course, which is fantastic, but not everybody can do that.
Well, I was just going to comment on the previous, from what Kay was saying, that I think we have this sort of dualistic idea of what it means to be technical. It's sort of, you know, you either have it or you don't. But reality is, even with people who have computer science backgrounds, is that their knowledge base is often fragmentary. It may be extremely deep on some particular system or some programming language, but they may know nothing about other programming languages or other kinds of systems. So there's a great deal of specialization there, and that creates problems in itself. And so when you say that somebody is technical, to us it really means that they have a great learning capacity, so that if they have to learn a different system, they can plow through it and learn what they need to know in order to use it. And so, and there's really, I mean, within the information professions, we're seeing a wide range of different levels of technical skill. So that, you know, I had one student, for instance, who was a journalist by training. He was once writing he wrote a food column in Texas as his first job, and then years later he became an IT specialist. So with no formal training, no computer science background, he just kind of discovered he had a certain capacity and then built on that and became, you know, took a very practical step-by-step approach of learning, you know, what do I need to know? How do I fix this problem? Where do I go to ask the right question, to find answers to my questions? And that's those are the sorts of skills that make you more technical.
To get back to your question about the soft skills, the real problem with that is sometimes that training is available in your institution or your area, but it may or may not be directly germane to archives. And I know this is something that came up with the Leadership Institute as it evolved, because they have a combination of senior archives folks talking and people from the university and the state covering some of the working with the media, working with the legislature. And the critique in the first couple of years was, this is all well and good, but the speakers are not tailoring that to archivists. Okay, so the participants were having trouble trying to apply what the speakers were telling them. And so I know the people who run the Institute have been working with, I don't know if did it was better this year? you know, working with the speaker to say, okay, this is your audience, okay? Make what you're saying apply to this kind of, you know, profession, these kinds of issues. And so when you get that, you know, if you get that kind of training without the institutional context, again, like EAD, if you take the workshop and you don't apply it, you forget it. If you take a working with the media or a change management kind of course that has nothing to do with archives, again, it's hard to translate.
I recently was told I was bridging from library to archivist. I took classes, in fact, in archives years ago. I have a boss who loves certifications, loves degrees, and I've been thinking, should I get certified now?
The question is, the audience is laughing. The question is, for someone who had some previous archival training but hasn't been in the field for a while and is now taking on archival responsibilities, what is the value, I guess in practical terms, of getting certified? It's a certified archivist. Sure. I'll answer it. But I mean, the process of studying for the certified archivist exam is in itself an educational experience, because one does have to study. And in many contexts, getting certified can mean more money, perhaps.
I wonder what that certification has played for anybody in the audience in terms of their own career path. Richard?
Let me repeat that Richard Pierce Moses is now going on the record on the record as saying that what you would not have the job that you have now if you were not a certified archivist, and that you were not always a believer, but now you are
a strong
believer, but now he supports it, and that it's on the official record now. For the reasons that I mentioned. Richard Pierce Moses will be taking the test this year, and we expect to have the results posted on Twitter. So we will all either be buying him drinks in celebration or not. Do we have any other people with experience with the Certified Archivist who want to share their positive or negative? I won't repeat it if it's negative. I won't identify you by name. To repeat the answer, which I think is fantastic, is that when you're studying for the exam, after you're out of school, you have probably much more time to actually read rather than skim, which of course some people do skim. I never did. But to actually read in depth the materials that you were assigned. But also, and I don't know if this was one of your points, but I'll make the connection anyway, is that if you've actually been a practicing archivist for a while, a lot of the things you read make a lot more sense, actually, when you have some context to it. So the experience of, what I'm hearing is the experience of studying for the exam. I mean, goodness knows you want to pass, but the experience of studying it is actually part of the value of it. Right, especially for people who've been out of school for a while, let's say 10 years or so. And we've got a question way in the back.
I was just going to repeat
that
Mr. Flick said.
And the comment is that Kevin said he wanted a firm foundation in archives fundamentals, and that's basically what the certified archivist designation does. In the green. And the comment is that recertification, it's not just the initial time that you get your certification, but the process of needing to get recertified forces you to refresh and learn things that are new. Sir?
Harkening back to Kevin's discussion.
Okay, and the way I interpreted that was, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the certified archivist thing is great for the kind of fundamental archival stuff we're talking about. But to get back to the issues of technology, how do you know somebody can actually do the stuff, the sort of hard skills technology stuff that we're talking about? Anyone?
Well, if you can say, write an application would be the best thing. That's what the real tech people do. They write an iPhone app, and they say, here's my app. And then you download it, and wow, you can do something. We try to build up e-portfolios for our students so that they can say, here's a database I built, or something to that effect, to show what they can do.
And I think there's two sides to this, Rob. I think there's one: if I'm the candidate, what do I do to make this show to the potential employer? And the other is, if I'm the employer, how do I evaluate, right? So I was talking to some interns a couple weeks ago, and they asked that exact thing about how do I make it show that I know this? I said that you really have to hit them over the head with this, because if I'm going to get 75 applications, I'm going to move through them quickly. And if you're not clear, if you don't emphasize, if I say something about those
technical skills, and let's say public services, and I say something about Web 2.0, and if you don't put in one of the first paragraphs of the cover letter something about how you understand and exactly how, precisely how you applied that knowledge, I'm not going to think anything bad about you, but you're not going to jump out because 3 to 5 candidates will do that, and then though you're not going to interview more than 3 to 5 candidates, right? So then you're not going to get the opportunity to then have the conversation where I'm really going to be able to figure out. On the employer side, it's tough to without the point about CA does help to as an employer to see something on the technical things without actual education or job experience, I have to rely on seeing something. So going back to this Web 2.0, for every candidate for a job like that, every name, I am finding everything that they've ever posted to the web to see what it is and what it looks like and what thinking did they put into creating that, and do they understand the ethical issues that are coming into their Facebook presence or their Twitter feed or whatever it is, and then if it's a website that they seem to claim some connection to, actually looking at that code and seeing, does it seem like they did anything unusual? Can I look at that second line and it says, you know, copied from X location or utilized this application and didn't really put a lot of thinking into it? But beyond that, that takes a lot of effort, you know, for 75 people. That takes a lot of time, but it is a lot more amorphous for the employer.
Yes, that's Amy Cooper Carey, who's another educator, and she's talking.
And a former classmate of ours, also.
And a veteran of the Leadership Institute.
and she was in a movie with Kevin Bacon, too. The very valuable point she was making was for students who are actually in educational programs, such graduate programs, that's one reason why most of these programs stress internships, fieldwork, et cetera, because then you actually, should have the opportunity to gain these kind of technical skills and have some sort of person who can also vouch for the fact that you gained them. So you'd be able to demonstrate that as well.
I wanted to flip that around. The archivists who support the internships, it's a continuing education in itself, defining the projects for the students, mentoring them. You learn from their projects, and that reinforces some of the soft skills that we've been talking about, and it's a way to get those soft skills just by repeated coordination with the education programs, taking the students, evaluating the projects. So it's a win-win situation for the archivist as well as for the student.
I'd also want to add that the concept of the internship isn't just for students at the beginning of their career. The idea of cross-training or mentoring can apply all throughout your career. And it's one of the things that sometimes we're trying to think of. We don't always succeed at Yale, but looking at existing archival professionals who want to develop new skills and looking at ways that maybe they can be brought into other projects to develop those skills, that they're only entirely focusing on accessioning, but they want to be more involved in exhibit creation, or they want to get involved in the digital surrogate creation or something like that. There's different ways of looking at that experiential education that can actually be on the job training, just not your job.
And we have a question over here. And
Christine back here.
Did you want to follow up on this? Or? And that's a great observation about how wonderful it is that Kevin himself can evaluate the technical skills of the candidates, but that many hiring officials don't have that capability themselves to assess the technical needs, and that it would be ideal if organizations like SAA or other academic repositories could basically help out, provide staff or some sort of a function where they could help with that evaluation of the technical skills of candidates. And you've had a question over there. Let me see if I can summarize that one. So for students who have more recently come out of programs,
everybody.
All right, for everybody, when you get these job descriptions where they have very specific things that they want, and then they also want you to be able to do everything else. Right, they want the whole package. They want you to be have all your fundamentals and all these technical skills and the whole grasp of the big picture. And they probably want all those soft skills that we talked about too: collaboration, management, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So exactly how do you become the perfect archivist? Is that your question? How do you, Mark? Are you going to answer how to become the perfect archivist, or are you just?
How did you develop it, though?
Wait a minute. I'm supposed to summarize Mark. I'm supposed to summarize Mark Matienza's brilliance for the benefit of the recording. Essentially, what he's saying is, of course, you can't do everything overnight. You're going to start with a certain base of knowledge, and then it's a question of you prioritizing both on the basis of your own personal interests and presumably what access you have on how you're going to build up in those other areas. And it's not going to happen overnight, but you also have to take personal initiative and responsibility, I think, is what you're saying, for building up, for broadening your areas of expertise.
And there's also a tension with something that Peter was saying. He was citing the example of computer science, opportunities that you're not.
Right, and that's the classic that you want to specialize in order to differentiate yourself, but you can't specialize too much because then you can't be as much of a generalist as people want. And we have a lot of hands up.
There's
so
two behind that column.
We have a lot of hands up. So. In the white vest in the back. Right. So the comment is that hopefully a lot of this you will be able to get if you have a good employer, you'll be able to get on the job, that they'll provide formal training experiences in some of these areas.
Before we ask, I want to go back to the question before Mark's, and she keeps wandering around in the back there. But I think one of the important points is paying very close attention to the job descriptions, right? So job descriptions are written very poorly. I think you can say that about many. But one thing that does happen is there is implicit prioritization of that laundry list that happens in the job description. And there's a little bit of experience and skill that goes into deciphering that. I definitely did not know it until I had to start writing them. The fifth or sixth, suddenly I started to see that. There are, the keywords in there about required and preferred and experience and knowledge, and you need to focus on the hardest requirements and the highest priorities in terms of job responsibilities, because that number six on the list, they might have thrown in thinking it would be great if we also got that. But if that's your best thing, maybe you're not going to be the top candidate.
I'd also just like to just say quickly that when you read the job descriptions and you see the laundry list of things that are ideal, there's a lot of ambiguity, and I mean, a lot of jobs in, say, digital projects are dealing with ill-defined problems that institutions haven't figured out yet. And that's ideally what they want someone to do, is to come in and figure out how we're going to have a digitization program or some such thing. And that's, I think, to get a leg up in the job market, if the more able you are to deal with ambiguity, the better.
Do you want to respond before we go to... Oh, snap. Person in the back said this was specifically a job at Yale, Kevin's institution that she was talking about. But can we get to...
I just want to say one quick thing about the job descriptions. A lot of institutions are stuck dealing with the interface of human resources or whatever they call it and having to translate what you want through the institution. And the first screening is not the archivist. The first screening is the human resources office. And they are being very specific in terms of checking things off. So if you aren't directly relating to that, it may never get to Kevin.
All right.
Yep.
Joel.
The whole world from the National Endowment for the Humanities. This is going to be a shameless advertisement, so full disclosure. But we follow Mark Labienzo's idea of a professional development plan. The question has to come up, how do I fund that? We have a grant program that I want to make you all aware of, if you're not already. I see my friend Joyce Ray from IMLS here, so I may have to yield for equal time at some point. But it's called Preservation Assistance Grants for Smaller Institutions. And as part of that program, it's possible for you to gain some of these hard skills through your institution, either to bring in someone to conduct a workshop, say on working with digital materials and digital skill development, or to send employees to SAA workshops or otherwise. And we'll be in the exhibit booth, or you can pigeonhole me at some point. I'm looking to see if my colleague Beth Jolteon is in the audience. She coordinates that program. I don't think she is. Anyway, an opportunity that we want to make you aware.
Yes, and I don't think that was shameless self-promotion. That's just saying there's money out there to help you do this, which is great. Through NEH, through the, what's it called? Small... Preservation Assistance Grants for Small Institutions, and part of what that will fund is training for people in the institution to be able to attack some of these things. And IMLS offers similar opportunities, and please see them in the exhibit hall to talk about how you can get money for your institution to do this kind of training.
Long-raised person in the green over there, she's had her hand up.
Told the person in the green is been very patient. Okay, for people in large institutions that have designated IT departments where you're not going to be doing hands-on IT work in the course of your daily work, and yet you want to get those IT skills, what should people like that do?
You're asking the wrong person.
I'm asking the wrong person.
No, okay. One of the challenges I see with all of my students is that they work full-time, and they are trying to do exactly what you're saying. They're trying to move into... from whatever their functional specialization is now, to moving into a job that deals with digital collections, and it's partly the money thing of how do I fund this, but it's really a time issue as well. And I would ask any employer, are you willing to allow your employees to take a certain amount of time off each week or a few hours at most? Give them a little flexibility so that they could undertake a program that might not apply to their immediate job requirements, but that could lead them to getting involved in, say, a new digital project or a new grant that could change the institution. And that's where the tension is the organization has to change in order to allow innovations to come in that will then create the demand so that you'll have to work with those, develop, so that it becomes the, pull. We have to, pull everybody onto the project and get the skills. But, absolutely, it's a real struggle.
I might first answer this with something that maybe doesn't help you in your current job. One thing to help you would be to question the existing situation. And see why it is that way. Why is it that that's the situation? But then beyond that, communicating more with that group to understand what they do is a real, effective way to be able to work that out. The other is maybe they can bring you into the loop. We've been talking recently about this sort of work for
paraprofessionals, where it's like a cross-training opportunity. Those units are just as hard up as our units are, and so they can see cross-training as an opportunity to get some free labor. But you get out of the cross-training a new skill set and set of experiences. And so the larger your organization might be, the more capable they may be to handle such a thing. But it sounds like this group might be set up to bring you into actually working with the Finding Aid database and how it's put together and how they actually deal with changes to Finding Aids at a higher level. That would be very helpful.
Okay, that was a two-part statement slash question, and the first one is regarding internal staff development programs. If you're at a place that's large enough to have one, a request for others to share information that they have afterwards about how you develop a good program or recommendations of good programs. And then the second part was regarding some of the restrictive or prescriptive nature of some of these programs, where you really have to fit into their mold about what you learn, and that doesn't work for everybody.
It's kind of a crisis right now, I think. How many large institutions, or especially smaller ones, have the resources to do staff development? I've worked hard with my library at the University of Arizona, and they've lost a big chunk of their budget, and they're just not doing anything, for this type. And it's a huge problem, I think, because We're struggling to just meet immediate needs, but not investing in what we want to, where we want to be in 5 to 10 years as an institution. So I think this comes down to leadership. Somehow we've got the people at the top have to make the decision that we're going to squeeze a certain amount of money as much as we can and as much time as we can to put into exactly the kind of programs you're talking about, because it's crucial. We don't know where things will be in the future.
Sure. One of the things that we've found out is that we have, Duke University already has
development. Yeah, the response was that if you're in a particularly big place like Duke and you have to go through a larger staff development system, which is not designed for the library or the archives, there's a communication issue in trying to educate them about what librarians and archivists need.
I've got a question on, I have experience like that since I'm in a large institution. Is there a role, is there anybody in the audience that can speak from consortial opportunities for smaller institutions, that sort of training that was discussed here?
Joyce?
Okay, that was a representative of IMLS, and I can't summarize that whole thing, but the thing that caught everybody's attention was the suggestion that an organization like SAA could conceivably apply for grant funding to develop some sort of a nationwide program of matching institutions that had an opportunity for people to get that kind of experience with people who wanted to get that kind of experience, to do a matching program. And we have only a few minutes left, so we will take one question. Wait a minute. People over there have been very patient. You get to be the last question. Right, and it's interesting because that came up in some discussions we had, and the concept is just that most people think of mentorship as going one way, from the more experienced mentor to the less experienced mentee, but we all know that sometimes those people who look less experienced have a lot of skills that some of the more experienced people could benefit from. And I think we are just about out of time, so I'd like to ask you to thank our speakers. And of course, please come up and ask them any questions that didn't get answered. Thank you.